Thanks, Mark. Okay, this talk is to, because I'm really a theorist more than anything else, and I also teach a graduate course in risk management, systemic risk. One of the things that I've really been interested in looking at is the types of tricks that people use in modeling liquidity. And being a general equilibrium theorist where I started out, you see, I've been around a long time, I'm really very old. And so I remember the theory in the 60s, long before you were born. So I'll sometimes refer to the older literature because there's stuff that keeps being found and people sort of forget about it. So I'll make references. Just bear with me, it's my age, you know, you younger guys. So essentially what I'm going to do now is have a look at some modeling tricks. All right. Some of this, of course, is all well known to you, but I just want to go through very quickly just to set the stage. So in the risk management systems, in the financial institutions, you, if you look at it and you think abstractly, a lot of it is really sort of arbitrary asset models, dynamic factor models, arbitrage pricing lies behind it, the derivatives, factor type structures and so on, all dynamic, and we'll come back to that in a moment. Now, illiquidity gets put into the modeling, and there's some suggestions for RM systems. The trouble is a lot of liquidity modeling is that they're done in very small dimensional models, and they're really theorist games to go through and think of the qualitative type results. And I've written in this area, a number of people in the room have worked in the area as well. So I'll talk about sort of three types of approaches, and this is not necessarily totally exhaustive. I'm still writing the paper and still trying to fit stuff together on a Procrustean bed. So the first one is illiquidity as a transaction cost. This is a very old literature, and you'll find it scattered in many different sort of sub-areas. Illiquidity as funding constraints, margin, VAR, becoming very fashionable in the last since the crisis. We see quite a number of papers using that. And then the last one is illiquidity as price pressure. And again, that appears in various parts of the literature, and I'll refer to it. I'll try to talk about how we would try to introduce all of these into the models and how we would try to make it operational, and that's tricky. I'll talk a bit about systemic risks. Don't ask me to define it, as Michael said, I know it when I see it. But I will talk about ways of trying to model it. I'll talk, say, it's early days, there seem to be some unsolved problems and puzzles, and I'm going to make some suggestions, and right at the end I'm going to talk about an idea that I've been pushing for some time. I've talked to people at the Bank of England and elsewhere, is that war games, and this is sort of a bit of a guy thing, so I know a lot about military history and wargaming, and it's kind of sort of a bit of fun for me. All right, just recall the basic two-date model. Let's go very fast, you know all this stuff. So you just take the sort of standard model, and of course you've got a random returns and the assets, and you can think about having some capital in there. You can have some total stochastic commitments. These are stochastic. You got the returns, et cetera. You got a budget constraint. This is a really pared down, simple model, and it's essentially a portfolio model. So if you took a book like Jorian or Cruey's book on risk management, they play around with this type of model to generate distributions, covariance structures and factor structures, et cetera, and then you look at the kind of distribution that you're generating here, and they're talking about, in a risk management system, a week ahead, 2 weeks, a month, something like that. And essentially, of course, we all know the standard tricks. The objective up here, okay, in terms of this, often we make it's von Neumann, Morgenstern, risk averse, et cetera, we play with it. But that's a kind of fake because in terms of financial systems and within financial institutions, you don't think of a really sort of nice objective like that. It's a kind of a dummy for trying to how the decisions are made. A little bit later I'll point out that actually it's this part that you tend to concentrate in the risk management system, and incremental changes. All right, the other trick, of course, we know is that if the markets are complete, then you've got a Q measure, martingale measure, or as all the old general equilibrium theorists, we've got arbitrary price vectors, and away we go. We're off to the races. We introduce factor structures, of course. We're all familiar with the APT type tricks, and if you've got factors, your K could be countably infinite. You accommodate to equity positions, government bonds, and all the rest of it you can throw into this. You use diversification across the epsilons, and that gives you the APT. The common factors allow arbitrage pricing to derivatives, hedge fund strategies, etc. This is the base of most of the credit derivatives and their offspring as well as a factor structure. Now, if you embed it in a general equilibrium system with market clearing, and we're just still taking a two-date, of course it extends in multi-date, and that complete the allocations are pro rata optimal. And the model, now the thing is, of course, being an old general equilibrium theorist, we actually knew this in the late 60s. And we knew that it was kind of funny. Subsequently, people have sort of worked on it and said, you know, with a finite horizon and so on, there's no bubbles or crashes or anything. Everything is optimal. We don't need a government. We can wind the Fed up. We don't need them. Value maximized, well defined. That makes life easy. Accounting is trivial. We don't need them. Wind them up, right? All valuations available is mark to market. You know, by the time you get in this, we're starting to have the students rolling around the floor laughing about why I'm learning this. All the assets are traded in perfectly liquid markets. Remember, liquid is perfectly competitive, so you don't have any price impacts. There's symmetric information, so you don't have to, and even in the finite horizon, very long period, take finite horizon several trillion years, you still don't have a problem. We can sort of, I'm making fun of it because the reason I'm making fun of it makes you, forces you to think very carefully about what's being assumed. Okay. So systemic network effects are solved as part of a competitive equilibrium. I worked on this part of my thesis. So you can actually have bankruptcy chains built into the thing, completely rational. I'm sorry, Viral, but you've been canceled. It's all right. You're on next. I'm just going first. So you can actually allow rationally anticipated bankruptcy chains. You solve for the fixed point of an equilibrium, and you'll find that the bankruptcy, everything is actually solved out. So the systemic risk is fully implemented, fully built into the system. There's no rationale for regulation and banking structures. And of course, a lot of people know this, and I'm just citing Grom and Vianos, but there are many others discussed this. And they talked about the limits to arbitrage and empirical examples inconsistent with arbitrage pricing crashes and so on. Now, you can take a finite tree or a continuous time counterpart, and again, we think of these as stochastic processes, and these are predictable, etc. It's your nice linear structure, which basically generates most of our results. We're all familiar with it, so I'll just pass on. Okay, so again, as I said, we get our dynamic counterparts, and again, of course, what happens, the objective, we get complete markets, unique, if you're right, you do your topology right in continuous time, you'll get a unique martingale measure and functional and so on. But of course, all the criticisms I made, the damaging criticisms, follow through for the multi-period. All right, now the thing is in risk management, they don't attempt to solve the whole problem. And part of it, and we're talking, and Joe was saying last night, we were saying that often the information systems are incomplete, and it varies across financial institutions of how good they are. Sometimes it's a bit horrifying when you hear stories about, you know, what they really know and what they don't know. Nevertheless, I'll put that to one side. And so if you look at the sort of standard teaching in risk management, graduate risk management, what you do is the following sort of trick. You simply look one period, a week, a day, or some period, you look ahead, and you actually try to generate the distributions knowing the positions, and you spend a lot of time on the stochastic process, specifying the joint distributions and so on. The other thing they can do is you can consider deviations. So you treat this as your position you've inherited, and then you think of possible strategies and deviations and how it will affect your distributions. So actually, that's where most of the action comes in risk management models. Now, more sophisticated versions look a small number of periods ahead, and they start to postulate strategies and simulate multi-period variations. So the conditional on things happening, you would change our strategies, and we try to generate and look at scenarios and so on. But notice the model is still basically Arrow to Brewer with all its limitations, and it's playing around with the joint probability distributions and the econometric estimation, change the stochastic process and so on, does not avoid the underlying problem that it's sort of misspecified, because we know that there are problems in terms of market liquidity, funding liquidity, and the models just don't take that into account. There are some fixes that people try, and I'll talk about some of them. I'm going to talk about modern banking theory. We've sort of got a balkanized profession in some ways. So you look at, I also teach graduate banking theory as well. So it's based on trying to get more realistic theory, allowing asymmetric information, strategic behavior. And so inevitably there's some game theory modeling that comes into the, this is what Roche talks about, it's really IO applied to the banking system. It emphasized liquidity problems. You know, the very earliest ones were sort of Diamond Dibvig type models and all that spawned. You find Alan and Gail pursuing that kind of, using those sort of tricks, looking at systemic risks. Look at the moral hazard, adverse selection in terms of credit and so on, incomplete contracts and so on. There's very considerable literature in this area. So the basic derivative and pricing and hedging and so on is based still on Aaron de Bruijn, but none of the predictions seem to apply in the standard stuff. So you teach any of the standard derivative stuff, none of this other stuff seems to get in there. Now, so again, you know, and I also try to tease my students to make them think. I know sometimes it's a bit hard, but we do it. And let's try to explain them that, you know, in this Aaron de Bruijn frictionless, the banks earn zero fuel profits. It's all perfectly competitive, and I wonder why they're getting big bonuses. And so they're all irrelevant under Modigliani-Miller, right? And I was an old friend of Mertz, and I used to enjoy this kind of conversation. All right, so as I said, the Freshes and Roche books, and Allen and Gale, they've discussed these sort of things. But as I said, I'm worried about this balkanization, how we can start to get it into the risk management systems. Now, I became aware of this here in this country. At around about 2005, 2006, I tried to run a conference for senior risk managers on systemic risk. And to my horror, I got the following response: what is systemic risk? And I realized they had no idea what I was talking about. Now, this might have been a very sophisticated answer, as is Michael, and say, you know, it's very... But no, I don't think it was sophisticated. After a little probing and a little horror, they had no idea at all of what I was talking about. Right, so coming back, the banking models are small dimensions. They're basically theory models. They don't take the risk management seriously. If you look at Freshers and Roche standard graduate texts, you find very little discussion of risk management. It kind of gets shuffled along on the side, and it sort of falls between the cracks. Now, the thing is, when you look at market microstructure models, they look carefully at frictions in the trading, but again, usually small dimensions. So you get, you know, more in Hara's standard book, and there's a nice one on Hasbrook, they're talking about trading. Now, a lot of, Joe was mentioning in terms of trading, a lot of banks really know how to do this. They don't dump everything at once. You know, you dribble it out. It's the old Pete Kyle story, you know, dribble it out over time and so on. And you find these price pressure models in there. And so this is one of the things I'm going to come talk about, is these price pressure models dynamically dribbling out the trades. Now, so this market microstructure has made some inroads into the financial models that are used by banks. But again, it's not sort of, you know, the risk management areas. All right, so something else I'm going to talk about too. It's a huge literature I'm trying to sort of come to grips with of how to try to put the pieces together. And there's big gaps in it. And that's what I'm going to try and start later in the talk about how we might try to address some of the gaps. The empirical models constructed by the central banks, Rama was talking yesterday, but I'm actually very familiar with Martin Sumrer at the Austrian Central Bank, tried to take the Allen and Gale network model seriously, and they tried to make it empirical. And it has holes in it, which people very quickly figured out. The Bank of England, the Ramsey model, is a sort of more sophisticated version of it that I'm familiar with. They use simple models of banks, balance sheet data, and algorithms as a fixed point theorem that you can track, and Rama talked about that yesterday. I don't want to go track back over it. They test for bank failures and systemic failures, so knock-on effects, whether we get change operating through the system. Now, the thing was that in the early days, things seemed very stable, and being of a suspicious mind, I looked at this and said, but I don't really believe it. It's fine in normal times. Who gives a damn? What I want to look at is when things really start to get rough. So we started to, some of us were thinking, and Prasanna Guy, who was one of my students from Australia originally, he was the key guy under Haldane who was making this operational. So we talked about liquidity problems. If when the banks started selling in certain markets, they would drive the prices down. And of course, we've become familiar with this sort of argument, Shin and others, because Shin was, yeah, it's a small gang of this guys, and Shin was also an advisor at the Bank of England. We had a lot of discussions of the price pressure effects. Even so, Andy admitted that we had trouble predicting the mess that happened. They really didn't get hold of the funding liquidity problems of Northern Rock, certainly not in this type of model. Although, it's, you know, in retrospect, it's sort of pretty obvious what was happening. All right, they're trying to make these models more sophisticated, but they have major limitations in capturing investment bank exposures. They're too aggregated. Rana talked about that. And they've got more complex counterparty risks. And now people are aware of it. Christian Upper has a paper discussing some of that, and Rana raised some of that yesterday. So the networks are a natural extension of this type of approach, and you've got those. And again, Rana talked about it, okay? Now the problem with that, they don't introduce behavioral reactions by the banks. That was also discussed. They use this very simplistic flat prior about how, you know, flat distribution responses. This is just not very accurate. So in fact, Guy and Capadia are trying to have a simple attempt to try to get at some of that. And I'm actually working with Prasanna on and Jim Thompson on a paper where you can get a bit more action, more flexibility in terms of reactions. So it's the responses of the banks when they get hit, either across in some general market, so there's a sort of like a big, like think of them as iterated stress tests, you get a stress, how they react to it. It's interesting to see the reaction. I'm going to come back to that right at the end of the talk of how to try to deal with this. All right, so there's liquidity impacts, and we talk about, I think of that as a price pressure effect, and we'll come back to that later in the talk. Okay, so this is sort of a, again, they're Arata Brewer, they so on. But what I want to do is, right at the end of the talk, I want to exploit the richness of the risk management models in the banks and hoping to get them more up to speed on the liquidity modeling, and yet then so we have the liquidity built in. But how could we do like a network model from the base up? In other words, from the financial institutions, we have to ask ourselves a question that Douglas Gale always would remind me for years we've talked about this. What is the market failure? That or failures. So address that. What are the failures? And then think of the instruments to address that failure. So people have talked, for example, perverse incentives. Is capital ratios going to help us in that, for example? Why are the incentives perverse? Why were they set up that way? All right, so that's one question. Another is maybe their risk management systems aren't very effective, and maybe they're misspecified. So if we specify them better, maybe that will help solve the problem. Maybe that's a second thing. All right. Maybe there's missing information that they find very difficult to deal with, and I'm going to talk about that with a knock-on effect to the network. The risk management systems can't cope with that because it involves the actions of a lot of people outside, and they don't have that, and they black box it, and maybe they're inefficient. Maybe there's an externality that we could try to internalize partially at least. So I'll come back to that. So running in the background of the idea is precisely what is the problem we're trying to solve. All right. Now I'm going to come back to more fundamentals. I'm going to come back to the risk management model within the bank and ask, let's think of these types of frictions or liquidity-type problems that people model. And I'll very quickly go through the tricks that people use, and I'll talk about the types of results you should expect. And I'll talk in an abstract way so that these are general types of properties of these models. You should expect these effects. And then, of course, you can make the models more specific, and you get more specific results. Market liquidity is transaction costs. That's quite old, as I said. Funding liquidity and other portfolio constraints. So basically, it's a portfolio problem with constraints built into it, and then it depends on the types of constraints. And John's going to talk a bit later about, I think, something like that. He certainly worked on that. Liquidity is market power, is a price pressure effect. Okay, external related to liquidity, the bank runs, but also informational problems, herding, and so on. And Joe mentioned that too yesterday. So there are lots of different things. An economist can always dream up endless sorts of, you know, effects that we can have. What's important is empirically how big they are, and it also may be conditional on the particular state you're in. So they may, most of the time, some of these may not matter very much for certain markets. In other markets, they matter an awful lot, and they explode in certain crises. All right. And we basically need to be simple enough to use the existing system. So that's a very strong constraint. Let's start first the liquidity as transaction cost. It's an old model. It dates right back to the 1970s. You look at Aaron Hahn, for example, old textbook. You find it in a used bookstore. I've still got it on my shelf. My bookshop looks like a used bookstore. But anyway, you'll find a discussion of that. And there are people that worked in that. The trick is that you assume buying and selling prices, and there's a bit of a spread generated by transaction costs. Now the transaction costs, we've heard a story a couple of discussions. Yesterday, they introduced costs of trading. That can be all put in there. You can assume it's the constant returns to scale, you can have fixed costs, you can have non-convex, You can do lots of tricks in here. And this is just black boxing a whole lot of problems in terms of cost. And of course, people have in mind either simply, you know, running the computer systems, all that kind of stuff, but they also somehow want to black box informational things in terms of those transaction costs. And it has some nice features. Its weakness, as I said, it fakes a lot of stuff, doesn't explain why the transaction costs in some markets are higher than others, and also that they could be stochastic. So the transaction, you can imagine this general model, and I'll talk about it briefly, you can actually, this thing's very flexible, you can allow transaction costs in some models and in contingent on some states of the world, they suddenly blow up in some markets. But why do they blow up in some markets? Well, in the end, we often think it's driven by informational things. The bid-ask spreads, if you go back to market microstructure, it's being driven by informational problems. And I've actually worked on sort of this fairly mechanical general equilibrium exercises to prove this stuff. Now, the partial characterizations of this, you can think of it as essentially it's stochastic, and you have the different buying and selling prices, stochastic processes, and these are the strategies, the deltas of the strategies, and you have some transaction technology. Now, there are various versions of this model that you can play with. It's quite flexible playing with it. You can, so from the first order conditions, what you can do is that you will find the ordinary martingale condition. You'll get two. You don't get an ordinary martingale condition because you get different buying and selling prices. And what you get is the valuation lies in between. Notice the I subscripts here and here. This martingale measure is no longer unique, and the trick is because the buying and selling prices are different, you can find your personalized valuations and the marginal conditions that you're getting as non-unique. Giuini, Talal, quite a number of others have all observed this. The second thing is that you also have some constraints in here that have to do with, I can throw in all sorts of constraints, short selling constraints, all sorts of things could be chucked in as well. So I want to just concentrate on the buying and selling. What you get is that this is the personalized valuation. So when people say mark the model, you can think of this as marking the model, because you can put factor structures in there and all that sort of stuff. But in the end, it's the model that you're choosing that's determining it's the martingale measure. So you find that, again, this personalized measure lies between the buying and selling prices in this type of model. Now, in terms of characterizing, I was just talking about first order marginal conditions, but you want to actually do some characterization. And there's been a whole bunch of papers that talk about this. The basic story that trading is sticky around the initial asset endowment, dynamic endowment, and then you get trading. George Constantinides had a very early paper way back, a long time ago, dealing with this. And people keep rediscovering the same sort of story. Now, the portfolio model does allow some flexibility considering changes in the transaction cost over time to mirror periods of illiquidity, and I mentioned that. That's a sort of trick that you can use. And then the thing is that you can see that when you do that, because you're solving a dynamic problem, you'll find that the strategies now, even though markets look, you know, very liquid, you may be, you're anticipating the potential for stochastic illiquidity in later periods. So that will affect the solution that you're going to get. So you can actually generate demand for so-called liquid assets that may earn a smaller return but have lower transaction costs to liquidate if contingent liabilities come due. And there's sort of models that do this, and it's quite a very intuitive in general about how things happen. So now if I got it wrong with John, he'll tell me I'm completely off. And they have a simple to asset economy and show the second best flavor of these constrained equilibria and surprising welfare perversities. Now, I'm going to say that this is not really surprising because this transaction cost model includes the incomplete markets model as a special case. If we just partition a set of assets into those that are perfectly liquid, no transaction costs, and those that have infinite transaction costs, that's an incomplete market. We know in dynamic models, you can get Hart saw this way back in the 70s. Again, this is ancient history, but you find that you can have multiple equilibria. Now, most finance people look at you if you're in cuckoo land when you talk about this, but you can have multiple equilibria, you can try to rank them. All I'm saying is if you start to work in this area and you start to do calibration, you've got to face up to it because you will discover it and you will suddenly find that there could be potentially multiple equilibria, but you could actually try to rank them. The second one is they get these, Hart first observed it, but I actually worked, I've got a paper with Hirsch Scheffer in the mid-80s on it in JET, is that they rediscovered the old idea of the theory of the second best, and every generation rediscovers it, and they're always surprised by it. And the trick was that Oliver had this little model where he showed that you get incomplete markets, and if you add one extra market, everybody was made worse off. And this was regarded as very shocking and had to be nonsensical. I was at Rochester at the time. People like Mike Denson thought this was completely stupid. The thing was, it was just the theory of the second best. You also find it in Hirschleifer's model, where he had common information and the information was made finer, and suddenly you found that markets shut down. Well, the Sheffrin paper and I set up a model which we included both of these within the same model. And so it was, you just showed it was just the same thing, the second best. But you get the same trick happening where you've got VAR constraints, for example, or you get any other types of constraints. And to your shock and horror, you can have a situation, you relax one of them, sounds good. So when Michael was talking about capital ratios, you actually make it worse off. And I'm sure we could concoct a model, and if I tortured it enough, we could probably show perverse results, right? But it's the second best, and you have to remember that. Now, how plausible that is in certain empirical situations is much more complicated to figure out. It may be, it doesn't matter very much in some situations, but there may be others where it does. The Diamond Divi bank run story can see as an example of this type of second best story, and you find it's because Douglas, of course, is an old GE theorist, Frank Hahn student, so he knows his stuff as well. So we often get this sort of flavor coming back of worrying about these types of constraints and creating these problems. Okay, I've sort of covered most of that stuff. I just had a crack here about accounting rules. My son, eldest son, works for Deloitte as a valuation manager in Los Angeles, and I explained to him that these valuations, if they really believe the models, we don't really need him. And he worries about the models and what they're assuming. But as we're following the FAS rules, it's fine. It's important to follow the rules, okay? And so also in terms of liquidity, you find that there's a judgment. The judgment is that personalized measure. And of course, with the illiquid assets, and you can't mark the market, the judgment matters a lot. And you may hold it to maturity. You can get that out of the models pretty easily, too. But as I said, they don't really deal with the underlying causes of the bid-ask spreads varying over time. They just mimic the type of symptoms more than anything else. And really what we need is asymmetric information. There's a survey that Tyrol filling his own models, and of course it's full of the asymmetric information stories. But they're very small dimension, and it's not something you would seem to be able to get into risk management too well. Now, of course, you get the dynamic trading with Black-Scholes and all the rest of it, the credit derivative models and all that, which I've been teaching. You get statements. Stuart Turnbull's an old colleague of mine, and when he was working on the credit models with Bob Jarrow, he would say things. I was safe on transaction costs, and I, being a theorist, I would rib him and say, well, where is it in the model? I can't find it, Stuart. You haven't got it in the model. And he would look at me as if I, and we'd make rude comments and then go and have a cup of coffee together. So this type of easy, you can start to model this, and you'll find, I'll mention later, Bob Jarrow has been doing stuff of introducing trading costs, and that introduces a bid-ask spread on the prices of derivatives. But again, they're fairly small models, and it depends how the transaction costs are put in, quite sensitive to that. And secondly, you find also that the model, the way he puts it in, it can deal with the price pressure effect as well. It has, the model in reduced form can have either interpretation, and he's been favoring the price pressure effect, temporary price pressure effect. Okay. I'm going to skip this, but essentially there's some results there. Now, if we introduce now asset economies with trading constraints or personal transaction costs, you can just modify the model a bit, and you can put constraints in. I've just thrown in general abstract constraints. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the case the buying and selling prices are equal. So we collapse the buying and selling. It doesn't matter now. It drops out. And essentially what we get is some Kuhn-Tucker conditions. Now, what happens when you do that in the dynamic programming problem for the particular agent, what you get is that you get these Kuhn-Tucker multipliers appearing. You'll notice a number of papers do this. And so what they get is it distorts the pricing process by the contingent Kuhn-Tucker multipliers in the future, all right? So they often talk about this as having distorting the martingale. But it's a very abstract result that you're going to get, and people often apply it in particular situations. Sort of in the background, they kind of know that, in fact, it's a very abstract result, but it destroys the standard, simple, classic martingale conditions. There are many simple GE versions of the model. They assume restrictive preferences in a small sample of assets. And you see some of these, the Garneau-Pedersen paper and their bibliography, and pricing distortions made by margin requirements. That's just an example of this type of technology that's being used, but you can have VAR, you can stick any of these in, and you'll get the same sort of result. Now, the thing is, you're distorting the Martingale conditions, and you can get factor-type models, liquidity factors. So the Kuntakas appears like factors, but the problem with them is that they are very stochastic now, and so it depends how you evolve over time, whether they become more important or less important. So, for example, there's a whole literature, and Pedersen has a nice survey. There's a sort of survey piece in the mid-2000s with Amahad and Mendelssohn talking about different types of tricks with these sort of transaction costs and constraints. And Viral is up the back, who can stop me if I say anything silly. He's not, so it sounds right. Okay, so they have a model which is cap-M pricing with additional factors generated by transaction costs and constraints. That's an example of this type of model. To make them work, you often have a lot of subsidiary assumptions. So, for example, there's an overlapping generation so that they force the sell. If the trading becomes much more endogenous, it gets a lot more tricky because now the choice to sell and trade is endogenous and people may not trade. Okay, so it becomes fairly sensitive now, the specification of preferences. So often you'll find that there are assumptions made on the structure of the model to force them to sell, and so therefore that gives this, it makes it a lot easier to solve it. The other trick you get into is the constraint sets for the moment. I haven't mentioned that you can have the asset price as part of the constraint set. In other words, the constraints be a function of the prices. And you find this in various types of constraints. You'll find it sort of implicit in VAR. You'll find it in margin requirements. It seems like a general equilibrium theorist. What happens, you have a general equilibrium model, you put the constraints in, and apart from the budget constraint, which clearly has prices in it, it's nice and linear, if you introduce other constraints with prices in it, this creates a sort of pecuniary externality in terms of the trading. For the moment, assume none of the constraints are binding. We've just got the standard model, Sarah de Brewer, all off to the races. Now imagine the constraints contingently start to bind. This is exactly the sort of thing that you and Pedersen and various others have been talking about. Shin, is that what happens is that when the price goes down on an asset, the normal response is we downward sloping demand curve, you buy more of it. With these types of constraints, it can reverse that. What happens, it can actually force you, instead of buying, in doing selling. And Shin's got a nice backward-bending demand curve type problem. It just comes out of this straight sort of this model. It's fairly simple. There's something to watch out for with these constraints, that the constraint can actually force you into doing trades. And a lot of discussion has been about forcing the trades. And this comes back to other questions about capital requirements. These constraints, when they're binding, they can, you're really careful you don't have a perverse effect. And the other thing to remember, when you're dealing with one agent in isolation, that's one thing. It's when you put in a general equilibrium and these constraints start binding, maybe there are some general equilibrium effects where it's affecting all of them. It may overturn. You just got to be a little careful. All right. I mentioned the Jarrow, so on, with their transaction cost type models. They manipulate the first order conditions and so on. It's fairly simple intuition. There are costs for not obtaining a perfect hedge anymore. We're trading them off against the present value of the transaction cost accumulated in the dynamic hedge. So it's what traders really do. The perfect hedging model, they don't really believe it. So what they do is they want to reduce the amount of exposure, they approximate it, and then you're trading off the transaction cost. So it's fairly simple. It's a present value calculation. Bob and his co-authors have what they've done is they've assumed there's a Martingale measure, which is a cheat, really. Because often they try to cheat it. One of them is a really simple trick. I've got to get this one. Is that you assume that the transaction costs around zeros in terms of trading is sort of bowl-shaped, quadratic-type result. And so what happens is it's around zero. So if you want to hedge it just a little bit, you approximate the transaction cost around zero, zero. So you get the standard model. Okay? And they go through a lot of math, but that's essentially the trick. When you get a sufficiently large position, then you're in trouble because the transaction costs matter. And of course, they get the very obvious intuition, and they give examples, where of course what will happen is that there are periods where you won't trade. In the continuous time mob, you're trading all the time, but in this case, you're not trading. And of course, you may as well do it in discrete time, because actually, a lot of the time, they do street simulations. All right, so next one, illiquidity is oligopoly pricing. And you find that in Hasbrook and various others where your trades can move prices. For most of my students, when I talk about it, and they talk about the way I characterize efficient market type story, it's just a very simple competitive model. You're a small trader, your trades don't matter. You don't matter, you're a nickel and dime. You're a day trader, you're not going to affect anything. But if you work for Goldman Sachs or Morgan's, right, when you move, the market moves, right? And of course, you will know that. So what you do is you tend to trickle the trades out. So it's very much like Kyle, if you had some information, for example, you want to trickle it out, you know, you play, we have all the standard tricks that we'd use, and so you want to spread it out over time, and these models start to do this. The markets are said to be thin, okay? So the trick is, being an economist, I would say, okay, the market's thin. Well, that means you've got oligopoly power. So you're effectively an oligopolist, and so therefore you have market power, and you can see where this is going in terms of antitrust legislation. So people talk about liquidity. I'm going to provoke you a little bit. People often talk about liquidity, and they sort of disconnect the statement from this question of market power. Of course, it's becoming very important. People are really talking about this a lot now, of how much market power there is. And so, is the market manipulable? This is the sort of story you'll find, as I mentioned in a moment, that lies behind the Burmeister-Petersen type model, and a lot of those models, where now you not only have market power for one individual, you just solve for one particular portfolio problem, but it becomes interesting as an oligopoly problem, a dynamic oligopoly problem where some trader, large firm, has to sell. They got into a problem, Bear Stearns, they're in trouble, and they're forced to sell. So there you've got Goldman's, you've got Morgan's, I'll get personal because you but you know what the problem is. So essentially you could front run them. So the Bruno Meyer-Petersen story is that you could front run them. If you know that, you can actually front run them down. Now, to make the model work, I'm thinking just straight economics now. To make the model work, they have a bunch of fringe traders out there, small guys, and they give you that downward sloping demand curve. Now, that type of model turns out to be really tricky to actually do. I'll skip that part. Here's the sort of model you've got. So the price, it looks exactly the same as the previous one, dynamic, except for this effect. Now, it's going to be very sensitive, this model, to the assumptions you make about this pricing function process here. And so you assume if you don't trade at all, it sort of just follows the standard stochastic process. Then the question is, if you trade, how does it affect the process? So intuition, is it a permanent effect? Is it a temporary effect? It matters in terms of the strategy. All right? So we covered that. Fine. Now, so in terms of the temporary effect, people have sort of worked through that. You find Hasbrook talks about it a lot too. And so the dynamics can be tricky. There's a trade-off between risk and liquidation in your strategy. Very simple intuition, but actually more complicated to do. Jarrow and Co. observe that, and they look at the very simple derivative literature in hedging. So their objective is very simple, and it's in terms of just a very simple hedging specification. And I mentioned the spreading out over time. Okay, now I'm going to take a strategic view. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put in the other traders in here. The minus H are all the others, big traders. So now you find that we've got to solve this as a dynamic game problem. And the way that's usually done is that it looks very simple in the abstract, but in finite time, you need something like sub-game perfect equilibrium. Second thing, all sorts of headaches. Things jump up straight away. So you look at the Bruno Meyer-Petersen story, and others have been playing with this. I've been playing it with Jim Thompson and also Prasanna Guy. You have to deal with the existence of equilibrium. You can wind up with potentially, without restrictions on the pricing function, you can have a problem, equilibrium existent problems. And there's also possible multiple equilibrium. We know in game theory it's very easy to get multiple equilibrium. And this is something, another headache in trying to specify it. And you'll see in the paper here they actually try to finesse that. Now the thing is that the model's very interesting for economic theorists because there's lots of interesting strategic situations, predation, interbank pressures, predation of prelude to takeovers, possible role for central bank. So let's put the central bank in. There we are. We've got Morgan's. We've got the Fed. Let's put in a small player, Bank of Canada. And you've got all the others. Now you can think of what the Fed is doing. It's a dynamic game, and so Morgan's and so on, they're all thinking strategically in these thinner markets. And of course, the strategy is going to depend what the central bank does. All right, so we're going to have expectations of what they're going to have. So what's the objective of the central banks? People like you, Joe, you're going to say, I anticipate what they will do is this. This will affect my strategy now, because I'll be thinking about it, because I'll be thinking of the whole strategy, the contingent strategy. In this, and say the Fed will be thinking, okay, they'll be doing this, and you know, we're off for the races and a nice game of thinking about it. Now, this is really fascinating, and I love it as a theorist. You know, this will keep me going till the day I die, and I can end with write papers and dream up lots of interesting stories, some of which I wouldn't even bother publishing, because you can figure out roughly what it is, and that's just entertainment. All right, so then the class evolves. Too tricky to use in risk management, as we've got at the moment, except in a very stripped-down fashion. They require a view on competitor strategies, the price process, and also that means the strategies. Banks are very, very secretive about their strategies. So you have to, if one player in the game theory model, you are essentially, in terms of strategies, we're making a lot of assumptions about what we know about other people's strategies. Remember, this is dynamic, too. This problem, when the more you think about it, gets more and more complex. It blows your mind when you start to think about it, but financial institutions have to try to come to grips with it. Well done. Yeah, that you're dead right. And that's something that I haven't talked about here, but that's something I've been thinking about. So when I used that utility function, that was one of the, it was finessing all of that. So when you think within the banks itself, you've got the different groups, the different trading groups, you've got the credit guys, and then you've got the risk managers out there. And one of my great pals said, being a risk manager is like ethnology. It's managing tribes, and they all speak different languages, and they've all got different incentives. And this makes it even harder. Okay? So I absolutely agree. So even with this will make gets it really mind-bending, right? So when you start to think about this seriously, and then you start to think about what happened, you start to think that maybe this problem is really quite complicated, and when we try to introduce simple fixes, you have to be very careful that it doesn't create all sorts of unintended consequences. And I suspect it will. Right, they've got non-price externality models. I won't go through this because I'm getting close to time, but you can see that you can introduce all these sort of non-price externality models, and it creates informational herding models and so on. These are sort of not adequately modeled in the standard RM systems that we have. Right, as I say, we've got these central bank macro models, pretty crude, top-down type models. None of this stuff is really embedded in it. Can we do that? It's not obvious. We can sort of fake it in a way, okay? We also have occasional stress tests of all banks in the system to a shock, but very limited feedback. So story is usually what you do is you give them a standard shock. What you do is you run through your risk management systems and you look back and you say, what did we learn from it? My view is that's stage one. Because what you really want to do is that then, as I ask the question, is an iterate stress test, now what are you going to do? Now, I'm going to say, you know, mind your own business, get lost, it's none of your affair. But actually for the regulator, the financial regulator, it's something they would really should like to ask. What would you do? So here's the sort of iterated stress test of what I call a war game, which brings me to the next part. Financial war games. It turns out in the history of military war gaming that arose in the 19th century in the German General Staff that war is like financial crises. They are intermittent, they scare the hell out of you, and everything goes wrong. It's called the fog of war. The whole idea of a general, you know, it's a Hollywood version, this Napoleon sits up there and he says, you know, this will do this, and if you play computer war games, it's great. You see it all, and you say, do this, do that, you know, and you roll the dice, and my sons play this. The trouble is, of course, it's much more complicated because what happens, this battalion goes here, it gets lost, this guy doesn't know how to attack, he's done something else. And in fact, in terms of Napoleon, when he started off, he sort of got the game going, then he sat back and watched it happen. Most of the battlefield, Waterloo was obscured by cannon fire smoke, and it was chaos. But they sort of went, go that way was the trick, okay? So it's like the fog of war. So they understood this, and then you had later, you would find that they had game theory in the 50s and early 60s, now we could use this new miracle of game theory to help us of how to defeat the Russians. Well, he very quickly found that the game, you know, is so complex that you couldn't solve it. We know Zermelo's lemma, which tells us that chess has a solution. We've known this for a very long time. It has a solution, but the number of moves is so vast that no computer could figure it out. So the question then is, how do you deal with that? Well, we know that computer programs are now pretty good, but how do they work? And it's the same with computer war games, strategic war games. They don't try to solve the whole thing. What they do is that they use iterative procedures where they weight strategies. And in fact, when they're weighting the strategies, it gives a very good feel for the way decisions are made by the opposing sides. And I play these games to relax at night and turn myself off and talk about financing crises. And what you do is the computer program, you figure out that it's got a learning algorithm in it. You find that if you want to really smash the other side, you can know that they're going to, and generally they'll move in this direction, you basically blow them up. But it learns, and then it starts altering the strategy. So what I'm telling you is that these types of problems that we're facing are sufficiently complicated that instead of trying to solve the whole thing out as a game, I'm going to suggest that we play it like a war game, an iterated stress test, to take the ideas from what the military had learned a long time ago. Actually, there is one that was run around about 2000. Kubrick has a book on it, and it was run as a game in the United States where it was a Middle Eastern policy problem, and it had financial overtones, and they ran this large game. Now, this was a very sophisticated game. The sort of games I'm thinking about, like countries like Canada or Australia or even the UK, they're kind of smaller. In the States, maybe with this, just using the large financial institutions, you could use it. So what you do is you use sort of like a stress test using the risk management systems to check through the first round impacts. Then you say to the central regulator, tell me, each of them, what are you going to do? Are you guys all going to sell down? So the next point is, turns out they're hurting. And they're all going to start selling down. You know, we're going to dump all these credit stuff. All right? So let's sort of downward sloping demand curve. We can all argue about it. But let's just see what happened to price. What are you going to do now? So let's run it again. So what I'm testing for is their reactions. And the thing is, I'm not trying to sort of totally predict it, because this, I would want to run one of these every 3 months. So what you'd do is that there'd be a learning procedure. And then people would say, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. And the other trick he would do is actually start to think through, as part of this, start to think through new products. As Joe was saying, the problem with new products. If people start to think of the new product, what could go wrong? It's an engineering problem. How would you stress this to make it give you problems? And then try to iterate it through the war game to say, we're going to have a problem, think about it. So it's really an educational process that I'm thinking about. This can be done well, or it can be done badly. You could run it in a mechanical fashion, everybody's happy, it's great. But what you want to do is press the envelope. All the time you want to be looking at, it's like, Boeing testing an aircraft. Let's put it through the shaker to find out what comes out the other end. All right, so, and of course you can, as I pointed out, the weaknesses. The FIs be wary of revealing their strategies. So what would happen? Let's say the Fed was involved, okay? And you say, we're not going to tell the Fed. But if you're running it every quarter, you can start to backtest all these guys and say, but you told me you'd do this, but actually you're doing that. I don't really believe you. So then the Fed can start playing games. So you can say, well, fellas, we've got this crisis, but there's political constraints. I'm sorry, we can't bail you out. Think about it. What would happen? So it's a way of sort of, if you think of playing in a sophisticated play, you could actually start to explore scenarios that people may not think, people say, of course, these guys will do X. What happens if they didn't? There are constraints that they don't. So how would you embed that to start thinking about the strategies? Right, as I said, they're only revealing as the design permits and the input of the FIs. The other thing you'll be watching, if the FIs start to see it's perfunctory, then it reduces the usefulness of the analysis. So it's only as good as what you get into it. And so the regulator, I think your prudential regulator, can start to juice it a bit and force. It also makes the prudential regulator get up to speed, because otherwise they're going to look like dummies. All right? So everybody's involved in this, and each is sort of judging the other, sort of how, you know, who's up to speed and who's not. And that puts pressure on the system for these, some of them, to get up to speed. And you can have penalties for imposed for not performing. Depends how ruthless you want to be. Okay? So you find biases. You see them feeding back in here. You can say the, you know, the risk management to these guys, you're not up to speed. It also gives you a feel for the risk management system of different banks to compete against one another. Gives you insights into that. Regulation, as I said, the regulators got to be up to speed as well. Educative, it's obvious. You can think through the implication of liquidity crisis, educated for regulator, etc. The central bank, seeing the impact of their strategies. If taken seriously, FIs may play strategic to hide real responses from competitors. Regulator can test their react. This is the feedback system. Okay. It's just endless. Once you start thinking about it, there are lots of possibilities you can think using this type of methodology. But the other thing you can do is that the kind of Ramsey model the Bank of England was using is a top-down. You would use these games as a way of trying to help calibrate that model as well. So what you do is you just don't use one system, but you use multiple systems to try to get a feel for what's really going on. Okay, so that's the message. It's open-ended. It's just a kind of open-ended idea that I had. But it seemed to me, given the complexity that you would get into these types of systems, and given the sort of strategic behavior that's going on, it gets really quite complicated. Thank you.